Muller House Meeting, Thursday morning, 22nd September 1977. There was a poem written by Tennyson to celebrate the Battle of Balaclava. That poem is called The Charge of the Light Brigade. And there is one line in it which goes thus: into the valley of death rode the 600. I'm sure all of you practically will know the story of that, how they were decimated. They were supposed to have won the battle, silenced the guns of those whom they called enemies, but they gave their lives for this. And giving their lives for this was commemorated as glory and as victory. But who felt the misery and the sorrow of the death, the tribulation of those who fell in battle? Is this glory, or is it vain glory? Is there not a glory and a beauty which is of a totally different order, and which really should distinguish and does distinguish on rare occasions the glory and beauty of true humanity? And surely this happens when one lives in communion. The result is not death, which is destruction. The result is that which expresses life in its real significance and beauty in the human kingdom, brings to fulfillment the purposes of nature, of God, of man, call it what you call them what you like. Such is the glory which the world extols, something which is hurtful, which is destructive. But consider the contrast with this valley of Elmau. Into that valley, in the Crimea, rode 600 to death. Into this valley there came a lone man by himself. Into this valley of peace and of beauty, a man of vision, Johannes Muller, who was concerned with this very matter of living in communion, living the life beautiful, by virtue of which man can truly flower out into his real manhood. He worked and lived here for many years. And he died in 1949. Let our memory go out to him in silent homage. And to his children, those who work here, let us give our gratitude and thanks for enabling us to have the opportunity to meet here and consider together, learn together, something of the meaning of living in communion. Because this, above all, is man's imperative need and longing. Today, in our day, perhaps more so than in days gone by. So, in the name of all of us gathered together, we pay our respects and we give our thanks and gratitude towards those of his successors who make it possible for us to meet here. Let us inquire, why do we come from outside Elmau, from other parts of the world? Why do we come to Elmau? Is it to find refreshment and peace, health and strength? Is it to gain benefits, bodily and spiritual? Is it to get away from the turmoil, the conflict, the stress and strain of everyday life and work in the city, in business, to get away from anxiety and heartache and frustrated longings? Is it in order that we may find a little rest from our intellectual distress when we try to look into the problems and challenges which life sets before us? Is it perhaps to run away from our own conscience? Because we are too poignantly aware of the flaws in us, our failures, our difficulties, and so forth. Yes, perhaps all these things. And we come here then to drop the burden, as we may say, to drown our sorrows. But do we in fact drop the burden? Or do we only push away sorrow, suppress it under the benign and kindly influence of nature and loveliness here, suppress it and push it down into the hidden depths of the mind? Let us feel all this quietly but intensely, maintaining an inward poise, because then we face the fact which we can never escape. We can never run away from the fact about ourselves, about our lives. We stay here for a while. we play pleasurably, go out for walks, enjoy the beauty of nature, grumble at the clouds and the absence of sunshine for 3 days at a time, and so forth. We gain a little strength, and then what happens? We go back into the same battle which we left behind us, from which we escaped. Have we really dropped the burden? Or have we only temporarily ceased to let us worry ourselves with the burden of life? This is a point of very great importance and significance. By seeking all the pleasant things, health, strength, spiritual benefits, and so forth, by seeking for them in our usual worldly way, which means for our own self, we have not healed the self of its sorrows. We have not clarified the mind of its confusions. We have tried to escape from it all. And therefore, when we go back, we are plunged again into the same problems. And we have to face them sooner or later, somehow or other. Now, this is a very important fact to bear in mind, because this is humanity's great problem, and humanity just doesn't know how to approach the problem in the right way. What we may succeed in doing whilst we are in a place like this is just temporarily, just for the time being, anesthetize the mind. We take a dose, so to say, of something which will blot out of our mind for a while the troubles that beset us. But to what degree is that really going to help us? Where does our trouble lie? We say it's business, it's the household affairs, it's this, that, or the other in the outer world. But there is another place where all these troubles live and do not die. That other place is inside ourselves, is it not? When I am dead, my troubles are dead with me. So, if I try to escape my troubles, I'm trying to escape from myself. But how can I do that? I can't run away from myself. If I come to Elmau, I've brought my troubles with me inside myself. I've only shut them up in my suitcase for the time being and put the suitcase on top of the cupboard. So you see, that is hardly a sensible or a practical way to approach our difficulties and problems. We have to wake up to the fact of the situation always. We can never run away from the fact. And we have to wake up to the fact, not in the spirit of antagonism, that I will face the fact and fight it. Oh no. You can't fight facts. Why? Because the real fact, the great fact, is inside myself. If I try to destroy the fact, to slay the fact, the vainglory of the world, I shall have to slay myself. Because I am the difficulties, the problems, the troubles, and so forth. I myself am that. And this we have to recognize. Therefore, we have to face the fact in a totally different way from the way of the world, not the destructive way, not what in the worldly sense we call a constructive way, but in the divine, in the transcendent sense, which is the only true sense for man, we have to face the fact in such a way that we ourselves are healed, made whole, made complete. There is nothing destroyed in us. There is nothing constructed in us, which is some new sort of construction. Because if we think in terms of some new sort of construction, we must remember, we must bear in mind, who is the constructor? I myself. But I myself, ignorant, imperfect, impure, am the source of that construction, just as this same person is the source of destructive activity. Therefore, it's not construction, it is not destruction. It is a totally new, utterly fresh and innocent understanding, realization, a penetration into the significance and meaning of life. These things are deep. They are difficult. But let us not complain about difficulty. There is nothing really good, really true, beautiful, wonderful in the world . There is nothing of that which comes from any worldly outlook. It has to be released by our ceasing to do that which spoils the beauty and marvel of life, which enables the healing process to go on. See, this is one of the supreme characteristics of life itself. It is self-healing. The healing doesn't come from outside. It comes from within the living being. Now, so since the roots of the trouble lie within us, and we cannot get away from our own selves, wherever we are, the most important change and movement which must take place is the change in our own nature and the movement in our own inner life. If our own inner life moves harmoniously, rhythmically, in tune with the life of the cosmos as a whole, then we are in harmony with reality, with truth. and the transformation can proceed within ourselves. Now, this is by no means an easy task, for the simple reason that we do not have to change merely the body or merely the psyche, what we commonly call the mind. This certainly has to change. But we cannot, as we are, look at body and look at psyche and say, it ought to be like this and I will try to change it into that shape. Because as I said earlier, I, the imperfect person, cannot conceive of the perfect shape. Therefore, there's something deeper still. And that deeper something is one's own mode of consciousness. In what manner are we conscious of our existence? Now, earlier on, I said we direct everything towards our own benefit. I want to be stronger. I want to regain my health. I want to be able to overcome my difficulties and problems and sorrows and so forth. It's all I. But is not this selfness, this self, the very source of the trouble? I am conscious of myself as just myself. I am in relationship with my immediate environment because people are around me here. Here is a room or here is a district and so forth. I am in some sort of relationship. But what sort of relationship? Is it a wholly open relationship? Or is my consciousness preoccupied with myself all the time, in relation to my neighbor, in relation to the office, in relation to the house, and so forth? This is the root trouble, is it not? I am conscious of the world in a manner which is not the manner of communion, of wholeness, of the open way between what I call myself and all that I call the not-self. Now, these channels of communion have to be unblocked. They are there. They all form part of our very constitution. They are there, but we have blocked them by this preoccupation with our own self. So now, we must see clearly certain things. We live and work in the world as if there was something for us, especially. There is everything for us if we allow it to come to us. But if we see that there is nothing for us which we can call our own forever and ever, whatever we may achieve or win or possess or attain, when we die, we leave all that behind, don't we? We can't take it with us. So for me, myself, as an individual, there is absolutely nothing. I must see that very clearly. When I really see that, when I begin to be a little bit free of this preoccupation with myself. I become aware of my environment, of my neighbor, of those who are around me, and the channels of communion begin to open up, begin to become unblocked by my selfness. You see, whatever we achieve in the world and possess cannot be the luggage which we carry with us into another world. We can't carry any honors or achievements or qualities or abilities as our personal luggage after we are dead. Simply cannot. So we have to understand that and not be attached to it here and now. If it comes, it comes. Let it be used in the right way. Let it go. Then one is not preoccupied with grasping this, grasping that, acquiring this, acquiring that. It comes, it is used, and it is used not just for myself, but by myself as a trustee for the sake of everything and everyone around. That is a very different situation, is it not? There are those, of course, who believe that they continue after the body is dead, and there are rewards and punishments in some mysterious other world for oneself. But now, what exactly are these beliefs? Are they facts? Are they reality? Or are they ideas, pictures, projected by the mind, projected by wishful thinking? But are they facts? That is quite another matter. And these ideas are pictures for me, made by myself whilst I am alive, by the finite living mortal, the one who will die. But are they facts? Are they reality for this same mortal when he is dead? What happens to all my pictures of heaven or hell or rewards or punishments when this fellow is dead, the maker of the pictures? It's very important really to understand this, because our fundamental fear, our fundamental aversion is towards death. We don't know the real meaning of death. We'll come to that in the course of these 4 days. So we are afraid of it. And we don't want it. We try to run away from it. And yet we know that it will come. But you see how we shut our eyes to the reality of death. And we don't know what death really is. So, the attempt to escape from reality is no solution at all. It doesn't release true communion. There are some who suffer in life so much and who sometimes are so upset inside that they even try to seek refuge in suicide. But is that any solution? That is the end of every possibility of healing. Suicide is no healing. It is an act of hate against oneself. It is an act of vengeance against society, expressing an act of vengeance, expressing both our flight from life and our hate of life. But this is no solution at all. If we continue to live and stay quietly and observe and understand and grow, then there is the chance of realizing communion and bringing about a true human state in ourselves and in our environment. Now, I mentioned suicide because that is the most extreme case of trying to escape. Consider for a moment, why do I want to commit suicide? I've been through this temptation in my young days because of misery and frustration and all the rest of it, you see. Why do I attempt to commit suicide? Do I want to do it? Simply out of sheer ignorance of fact, of reality. Out of the refusal to face reality. But the moment I actually face reality, I suddenly find that I have become free of my concern for myself, for my wanting for myself. You know how a petulant child will scream and rage against the parent or whoever is by because it doesn't get what it wants. The child doesn't know suicide yet, so it only shouts. But the grown-up can perform the actual act of hate, the act of ignorance. It's tragic. But in small ways, we don't go to that extreme, but in small ways, we do the same in our lives to escape reality because we want for ourselves to grasp for ourselves. But we must see clearly that if this change in the innermost depths of consciousness is to take place, and we are to awaken to truth, to reality, to the meaning of what it is to be human and live as a human being, then we must be free of this selfness, wanting for oneself. Then you will find that the whole world will pour into you. You can't stop it. Life is constantly pouring its gifts for each one of us. And life has a wisdom and a knowledge which utterly transcends anything that we have of wisdom and knowledge. It knows just what is necessary and good for us. It's a mystery. But this is the omniscience of the divine itself at work. We have to wake up to that fact, not merely believe it. Beliefs, mere beliefs are useless. Because when you merely believe, you are trying to retreat behind some barrier. It's not that. See the fact, and it'll be there in all its richness. Let us just go on an imaginative journey in time for a few moments. Let us go backwards in time on a voyage of exploration in relationship to the question of what sort of change in consciousness, in the deeps of consciousness, takes place. Look at our world and ourselves now, in the year 1977, in the month of September. What is our state, our condition? On the one hand, we'll just consider the so-called good things for the moment. We have a wonderfully developed society in technological terms, in terms of machinery, invention, and so on, to make what we call our daily life easier. We have grown in knowledge, the knowledge of nature and how to control nature to such an extent, to such a terrible extent, that we have come to the point where we can easily destroy ourselves if we make a slight error of judgment, even a slight moral mistake in how we handle our power. The world is under the fear of the atomic bomb, the fear of destruction through the mishandling of nuclear energy. But it also holds a tremendous promise before us. Just sort of feel our present world state. This is how we are conscious of the world today. With all its marvel and wonder and all its possibilities of complete destruction of the whole human race. Let us jump back to 1977 BC, nearly 2,000 years before the birth of Christ. Abraham was walking across the desert with his camels and with his family and so forth. In what manner were those people conscious of the world and themselves and their relationship to something transcendent, the source God, as they called it, Yahweh, from whom they came, who created them and so forth. In what manner were they conscious? Quite different from ours in so many important ways, wasn't it? What sort of art did they have? What sort of skill? What sort of technique? What sort of institutions? Compared with ours, quite simple in certain ways, backward in certain ways, perhaps a little more advanced in other ways, but quite different from ours. Let us take another step forward, go back to Acherlian times, 100,000 BC. When men made implements of flint and stone, when their very bodily structure was different from ours, quite different. They were not so upright as we are. The physical structure of the body and the psychophysical functions of the man were different from today. And if you like to go back, jump back to 2 or 3 or 4 million years ago, you and I were still the primordial animal who was going to become the creature man. Now, how was that primordial animal conscious of himself, of life around him, of nature? Had he any sense of divinity? But there was something extraordinary about him. He was in constant communion with life. Unconsciously, absolutely unconscious. And as he changed, and his bodily structure changed, and his capacities changed, his control over nature began to grow and so forth, then he slowly grew into what we are today and became conscious of himself and his existence in today's way. You see the tremendous difference. Now it is that fundamental change in the depths of consciousness which is the root source out of which all the changes in our intellect, in our aesthetic faculties and so forth emerge. That's the fundamental change, the way in which we are conscious of ourselves and the world in which we live. The animal, when we were in that animal stage, we felt and thought, no, I don't know about thought, but certainly we felt only in terms of drawing life to us so that we may continue ourselves and the species may continue. So food and sex were the only problems of the animal. And they weren't problems. Everything happened at the right season, in the right way, according to the forces of nature. But as we became more and more self-conscious and we changed, our present situation ultimately emerged. So you see, the difference is something tremendous from the way in which we were conscious when we started our evolutionary growth and became men, and the way in which we are conscious now. This is the fundamental change. The manner in which we are aware of the world. And to be aware of the world in this sense does not mean just to have an idea of the world. Because the idea is something external to us. This manner in which we are conscious is something which you cannot define. You cannot say it is this or that or the other. It's one of the great mysteries. So this we must bear in mind. The question arises, how do we let the change in consciousness emerge out of us? We can't produce it. Life does all that. But we have to learn not to block the processes of life. This is not easy. When we begin to understand this, and we learn to be fully awake to our own selves, the life around us, and the manner in which things happen by themselves, then we make it possible for these channels of communion to become unblocked and let transcendence itself realize itself through us. We are the vessels, and our business is to make those vessels clean, to let the shape of these vessels be the right shape. And by shape in this connection I mean the way in which we think and feel, speak and act. Ears will hear sounds. Now, instead of letting the senses function in the usual way, I am seeing, I am hearing, I am touching the earth.
awake to the fact that there is a seeing, a touching, a hearing taking place. The phenomenon of seeing or hearing or touching is a universal phenomenon. It's not just I seeing that. If I am conscious all the time in terms of I and that, there is the everlasting separation. There is no union. There is no communion. You see? You see, and you will find that when you look at a tree, you'll say, oh, that's a fine tree. Or you'll say, oh, a tree, not good. So, you see, you get this constant state of conflict. But supposing, just imagine, if you were God, does God reject anything? Does God have to accept anything? It's all there in one totality. But we are never conscious in those terms. We are always conscious in terms of separation. Separation is the root of conflict, the root of sorrow. Myself and the not-self. So you see, let the senses be used in such a way that there is no separation. It is transcendence, God, looking through your eyes, not you looking only. There'll be you looking also, of course. But be conscious of totality all the time. Then self and not self are no longer enemies. The state of harmony is really growing. And you'll find a totally different kind of happiness coming out through the use of the senses. Don't believe all the old misstatements in the past that the senses are the deceivers, they are the devil's agents. Not at all. They are the channels of communion. See, it's the manner in which we are aware. We are conscious, the manner of the consciousness, which makes the complete change from conflict and evil into harmony and purity and goodness. So let us walk that way, calmly, peacefully, letting the brain be quiet. Just let the brain be quiet and just let the senses be used completely and perfectly. This is a great art. This is living meditatively. Let's just walk. Awful tendency to talk all the time whilst we are walking. We are silent with our tongues, but the brain is talking away. Just let the talk quieten down if possible. This is very, very difficult, of course. You look at a sight like that, and the brain immediately says, what? What majestic mountains. Instead of the brain saying that, let the whole being feel the majesty without describing it. The moment you describe, you separate. You get this sense of totality. This is it. Just the whole thing, the feel of it. Just be conscious of it. You know that wonderful line in the Psalms, Psalm 40, verse 10, I think. Be still and know that I am God. What has to remain still? The talking brain has to be silent. Then you will know with a very different kind of knowing. The knowing which is true communion. Because if the brain is quiet and all the senses are at peace but functioning fully, then you are really still in the true sense. That is the real silence. And the knowing is not knowing in our ordinary sense, I know that that is a tree because I see it there, you see. You know it because you have become it. This is the great mystery, the change in consciousness, the mode of consciousness. When you are really conscious, when you are really aware in that way, there is no separation whatsoever. There is the state of communion. This is the meditative condition, the state of unity, the state of harmony. This is one of the profoundest meanings of yoga. The restoration to totality, the rejoining of that which was broken off from the whole by my self-consciousness, that is once again healed, made whole. Otherwise, I means different from all this, separate. And that's the root of all sorrow and conflict, one against the other. So you see, let the senses function fully. I think you can feel it for just a little bit even, suddenly. If we are conscious in terms of difference, the relationship is not complete. But if we let ourselves be aware in terms of variety of the one thing, then you are conscious in terms of wholeness, not of broken bits. That is the great difference. And that is very important. See it as variety. Anything, everything is wonderful, beautiful, marvelous on its own. Look at that. Look at the grass. Look at the trees. Look at that meadow. Look at those mountains. The variety of the one reality. If you are conscious that way, you will find yourself getting free of the differentiating, the rigidly, sharply differentiating element, and then the state of conflict within your own consciousness changes into a state of calm. It's extraordinary how it happens. You have to let it happen. Don't say, this ought to be the case and this must be brought about. It will happen. And then there is peace inside. You don't have to go out to seek peace. It happens there. It happens here. If we look there, notice how the brain ordinarily will separate out. This is nature. But those buildings are man-made things. and we feel it as not nature. But is it not nature? Bricks and tiles and wood and stones, they all are part of nature, isn't it? We awaken this way to our own likes and dislikes, our prejudices, our biases, and our tendency to tell life what it ought to be. Tell God he ought to have breakfast at midday. It's as absurd as that. It's all part of one wonderful whole. And it's that sense of wholeness that we today haven't got. That's the root of our troubles and our sorrows, conflict and our illness. The sense of wholeness, holiness. Then you won't go into battle with anything. You'll be able to let everything just remain a harmony. It is I who interfere with life. That doesn't mean that I, as a man, do not change things. Change is necessary. But if that change is the result merely of my desire against somebody else's desire, I'm in a state of conflict. We will do the right thing naturally. You might say, then, what is the difference between an animal who does things instinctively and a human being? A human being adds the richness of fully awakened consciousness to the reality, which the animal doesn't. The animal remains unconscious. But the human being can wake up. And that's the beauty and marvel and wonder of us being humans. And you see how so many things combine: sound, shape, everything. It's like a symphony, isn't it? The theme, the counterpoint, and all the rest of it, making up the harmony of the whole. You have drums and stringed instruments and wind instruments and brass instruments. You have mountain and tree and meadow and stream and human beings and cars and aeroplanes, all contributing their sound and their existence. But we reject this and choose that because we dislike this and we like that. But does the divine reject or accept anything? This is the difference, isn't it? Well, what would you like to do if you wish to sort of proceed on your own in this manner and experience that inner quietude? Then it has become a true, practical, meditative walking. And it releases the wholeness within us of our own selves. The atoms and the substances that make up all this are the same atoms and substances that make up this. The old people called it fire, air, earth, water. We say today sodium, potassium, iron, magnesium, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and so on. Or we may say electrons and protons and whatnot. The words are different. The brain knowledge is different. But the reality is the same. But we have lost the complete harmony with that reality. And hence our world of human beings is in such awful trouble and misery. There was no charge of balaclava ever for those mountains. No one rides to destruction and sorrow and death. Yeah, those mountains are concerned. It's only we who do such foolish things. And we say we are clever people. So, I will go back and collect one or two things which I have to collect. And you move on as you please. You see? Spend a little more time. Just by yourselves, if possible, walking meditatively like this, and see what happens. Just observe.
What time is the afternoon, sir? Hmm?